Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Language, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Coulter George, author of How Dead Languages Work, published in 2020 by Oxford University Press.
Thanks for taking time to be on the podcast, Coulter.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so let's start in with why you decided to write this book. So it's on dead languages, and you are a professor of classics at the University of Virginia, but most of your publications focus on Latin and Greek. How did you come to write a book that also includes Sanskrit, Old English, Old Irish, and Hebrew, as well as Latin and Greek?
Well, I've always been interested in a pretty wide variety of languages. It's true that the first language that I gravitated to was Latin. I, in fact, started Latin in third grade. After that, added various ancient languages. I started ancient Greek in 10th grade, did a semester of Old Norse in 11th grade. Then as a freshman at Rice, I went to the bookstore and the start of classes to decide what classes to take, and because I had one free elective saw that they had a textbook with a cuneiform in it. So I decided, oh, I have to learn Akkadian as well. So all along the way, I've always been, omnivorous in terms of the languages that I'd like to be, that I'd like to learn and be working with. One can't be a specialist in all of them. So Greek is really the language that I focus on the most. But it's hard not to be interested, to sort of notice similarities and differences mm-hmm. between them, to appreciate both the similarities and the differences. And since not a lot of people are lucky enough to have the opportunity to learn this many ancient languages, to get a chance to share a lot of what makes them so special to me. I mean, in terms of the, so that's sort of the personal reason mm-hmm, to write the book, but in terms of a more, I don't know, wider public context, I don't think that Anglophones generally do a very good job of learning other languages. And this is understandable because we all have a vast number of competing demands on our time. And mm-hmm. with so much stuff having been translated into English and with it being so easy to find to sort of when you're overseas to communicate with people in English, it's understandable that many Anglophones decide it's not worth the trouble. But naturally, I think this is a huge shame. And so I do think it's important to try to share this. Then the question becomes, why dead languages and not mm-hmm. modern languages? That's more to do with my own personal inclinations. I think that a book like this on modern languages would also be great fun. Mm-hmm. But I'm personally interested enough in the past that ancient medieval languages are the ones that that I've chosen to work with mm-hmm. professionally. And I do have the sense that in 21st century America, there's a sort of utopian streak about technology fixing everything, that we can be a little bit short-sighted about the whole of human history that took place before the internet age. I think it's nice to gain a certain amount of temporal perspective on things by understanding that, you know, there's thousands of years worth of literature and history and philosophy that we'd be drawing on and not just be focused on what's in everybody's Twitter feed.
Yeah, that's great. And this book definitely gives a tour of a lot of important, we could say, pre-modern literature and culture. So maybe let's talk a little bit about the term dead languages. I mean, it's a term that gets tossed around a lot, but are these languages really dead? Should they just be contrasted to modern languages? What do you mean by that term?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, of course. For me, the term, I use it in a lighthearted, tongue-in-cheek mm-hmm. sort of way. What I like about it as an expression is the fact that it does, at some level, capture, at an intuitive level, the fact that we think about Latin and ancient Greek and biblical Hebrew and Sanskrit in a different way from how we think about Sanskrit, think about Spanish and French and German. Mm-hmm. And there, if you take a beginning Latin or Greek or Sanskrit class, you're going to be doing different things from if you're taking a mm-hmm. beginning Spanish, French, or German class. Mm-hmm. And this makes sense given the different aims that you have. If you are learning Spanish or French, you're probably not just wanting to read Cervantes or Proust. You probably also want to travel to Spanish and French language countries. Mm-hmm. And to communicate with people. Whereas despite some noble efforts to get spoken Latin and ancient Greek and Sanskrit going, it's mm-hmm. still, it's unlikely to be people's primary motivation for learning the languages, right. Which really is generally to be able to read texts. So I do think it can be useful to bundle these languages together as a group mm-hmm. in opposition to the widely spoken modern languages of today. And the other thing, too, that I think it's worth saying in terms of, I mean, are these languages really dead or not, mm-hmm. Is that it's deliberate in the book that I use the present tense works after dead languages mm-hmm. as a way to actually invite this question. If we can still think about these languages as systems that operate in a sort of timeless, omnitemporal way, mm-hmm. Do we really want to, as indicated by a present tense, mm-hmm. To what extent are they dead? And I mean, there's no simple answer to the question. Mm-hmm. In one mm-hmm. sense, of course they're dead in the sense that you're not going to be able to go into a pub and order a Guinness using Old Irish. but as long as people can have their intellectual horizons expanded by mm-hmm. Learning some Greek, learning some Old Irish, learning some Sanskrit, then no, of course they're still alive and have much to communicate to us.
Right, right, yeah. And so in the book, you're focusing on dead languages, focusing on languages that have sort of been established or frozen in some sense in the past in this form, but you're also thinking about some. A bit of a broader question about language more generally, and that's the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. You mentioned this in your introduction, and this is a hypothesis that isn't just about dead languages, it's just about language in general. So maybe you could tell our listeners, for those who aren't familiar with it, what the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is and how this is relevant to what you're doing in this book.
So it's a hypothesis about the relationship between language and thought. It exists in several different forms. There are stronger and weaker formulations of it. And the stronger ones tend to suggest that language determines the way we think about the world. Weaker ones suggest merely that it influences the way we think about the world. Reject the stronger version of the hypothesis on the grounds that we are actually at some basic level pretty good at translating things, ideas from one language into another with some rough degree of equivalence. Mm-hmm. You don't have a particular word for one concept in one language. But that doesn't mean that language can't coin a new word for that concept or express it through a phrase or mm-hmm. borrow a word for the concept. As often comes up in the sort of the idea of Eskimos having umpteen number of different words for snow, this trope simply isn't particularly accurate in that It requires a lot of fuzzy counting about what counts as words for snow, mm-hmm. and people in other languages are also perfectly capable of coming up, of describing lots of different types of snow, mm-hmm. With different words. So in the sort of strong sense, as it often comes up in the popular media, it's largely rejected. That said, there certainly are some things that it is easier to express in one language than in another. And this is what I find interesting. To take things back to ancient languages, two words that come up very quickly in teaching a beginning Greek class are two particles, men and death. Mm-hmm. And these are traditionally translated as on the one hand and on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And that's a rough equivalent of what these words do, because they do oppose two different ideas. But it's also a lot bulkier saying on the one hand and on mm-hmm. the other than it is simply saying men and death. Mm-hmm. This means it's a lot easier and more natural for a Greek writer, an ancient Greek writer, to express things in terms of balanced pairs, which then lends a certain veneer to the style of the language.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So in this book, what you're interested in then is helping people see kind of what sorts of things are easily or naturally communicated in some of these dead languages, as opposed to other things. So both across the different languages, how they're able to or not able to kind of convey things easily, and then also maybe in contrast to English, which is the language the book is written in. Is that fair? What is it that it's?
That's certainly that's certainly fair. I mean, another. Metaphor that I like using to describe the different languages, that they have different flavors. Mm-hmm. That they're just certain things that, that just as one can enjoy, one likes to sort of go out to different nationalities and restaurants, mm-hmm. In order to have a sampling of Asian food or Italian food or the like. And there's something that's a little bit different about mm-hmm. all of them, even they begin with the basic, certain basic ingredients. Mm-hmm. So too with languages, you sort of start from some basic ingredients that are probably universal to all languages, but then different languages do different things with them. Yeah. Especially seeing the languages rooted in a particular cultural context, mm-hmm. One can start... really appreciate better what the relationships are between them and why Greek might have a certain feel to it and that's different mm-hmm. from the feel that Latin has mm-hmm. for an English speaker.
Mm-hmm. Great. So maybe let's continue the metaphor of the flavor. So you're saying there's certain mm-hmm. basic parts, right? And so, you different flavors, you can have sort of related dishes that have some of the shared constituent parts, but they vary in different ways. Well, in language, there are certain sort of features or parts of a language, and throughout the book, you're sort of taking these in turn. And so, maybe before we dig into Greek and Latin, what are some of these different features? So, you talk about phonology, morphology, and the lexicon. What are these concepts? How are they related to language? That's going to help us with when we get into them.
No, it's very important in discussing language to have the proper terminology for the constituent parts of the language. Mm-hmm. For me, it's easiest to think of these in terms of starting from the smallest building blocks and then expanding from there. Because languages essentially are systems that create meaning out of sounds. And one begins with the sounds of the language, because different languages have different sets of sounds at their disposal. And this is the branch of linguistics called phonology that talks about the sounds of the language, how they work as a system within that particular language. But you're not going to get very far if you only have sounds to work with. You need to build them up into words. If you are interested in building up building a new word or doing things with changing the form of a given word, then you need the subdivision of linguistics called morphology from the Greek word for form. This is With morphology, we're doing things that are either what's called inflectional morphology, changing the shape of a given word, so adding an S to make it plural in English, or we're doing derivational morphology, where we're taking one word and building a new word off of it, perhaps by adding a prefix or a suffix, so forming playful from play. So once you've done that and you've built your words, then you need to arrange them somehow. And this gets into the area of syntax with word order being important in creating meaning, especially in a language like English, where whether or not a noun is a subject or an object of a verb is dependent on word order. Unlike a language like Latin or Greek, where it's dependent on the morphology. And this is one reason why it's so useful to introduce terms like this, because it's a lot neater to say that Greek and Latin can do with morphology what English does with syntax or word order than it is to be, if you don't have morphology as a word at your disposal for mm-hmm. talking about the fact that Latin and Greek have lots of endings that they mm-hmm. can slap onto nouns mm-hmm. or verbs. Now, all of these sort of grammatical building blocks get applied to the stock of vocabulary that a language has, its lexicon. Insofar as we often think of particular words as being associated with particular cultures, it could be useful to highlight a couple of key words from a language as well to give an indication of how that language is viewed. And I keep reaching for Schadenfreude as being sort of a word that we think was being especially German. But one can come up with similar words for ancient languages as well. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Great. So then let's dig in here. We've got a few languages to get through. Let's start with Greek and Latin. You've been talking about those sort of as a pair, and I think there's some good reasons for that. So how are they related, these two languages, and how do we know what their relationship is?
So the interesting thing about Greek and Latin is that they are studied together because they're related culturally, and they are in fact also related at a purely linguistic level, mm-hmm. although it is primarily the cultural reasons that predominate in why these two get paired in a group rather than the strictly speaking linguistic reasons. What do I mean by any of that? Well, the main thing that Greek and Latin share at a linguistic level is that they are both Indo-European languages. What does that mean? The Indo-European languages are a family of languages spoken all the way from Ireland in the north and Iceland in the northwest to India in the southeast, and then in the post-colonial age, a wider field than that even. Mm-hmm. But these are all languages that can be shown to have derived from a single common ancestor called Proto-Indo-European. This might seem a pretty bold claim. How can we tell that Old Irish and Sanskrit, Greek and Latin all go back to a common source? And the answer is simply that there are too many shared similarities between them in terms of their vocabulary and in terms of the grammatical patterns that they use for the endings that they have for expressing number on nouns or person and number on verbs. There are too many similarities for this simply to be due to chance or due to borrowing. In fact, given the fact that the correspondences of the sounds in particular are governed by remarkably regular patterns, it's in fact possible to reconstruct what the parent language, Proto-Indo-European, would have looked like. So to make this a little bit more specific, it's a little bit hard. Usually when I teach this in class, I have a blackboard to work with, so it's a little bit strange. trying to do this all simply descriptively with words. Mm-hmm. But one can get a sense of this by thinking about some common words for, say, the words for father and fish. Mm-hmm. These both start with an F in English, but the Latin words for father and fish are pater and piscis, and they both start with a P. The word for foot starts with an F in English and starts with a P. Pes, pedis, in Latin. So this sort of correspondence, which can be extended to a host of different words, is best explained by positing that there was a parent language that had one sound, in this case probably P, which remained a P in Latin but changed to an F in the Germanic languages. It might seem a little bit arbitrary to say, why should the P change to the F? Why not the other way around? Mm-hmm. But once we start looking at other languages, we see that Greek also has words for father and foot that start with a P. And Sanskrit also has words mm-hmm. for father and foot that start with a P. Mm-hmm. That combined with the fact that we do have the attested history of certain historical languages, so we can get a sense for which sound changes are a little bit likelier to occur mm-hmm. than others. And a P weakening to an F is a little bit easier than an F hardening into a P. Mm-hmm. Given this, we can get a good sense that all of these languages, the Germanic languages, the Celtic languages, Latin, Greek, the Indo-Iranian languages, Balto-Slavic, Armenian, all these languages go back to one common language. Mm-hmm. Now, to zero back in on Greek and Latin in particular,
right.
It's funny. I mean, because we study Greek and Latin together culturally for cultural reasons, because the Romans in particular were heavily influenced by Greek culture, and sort of speaking Greek as an ancient Roman was an expected sign of polish and education, mm-hmm. Much as speaking French would have been in 19th century England. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much cultural cross-fertilization between Greece and Rome, this becomes a field of study that we know as classics. And it's easy for classicists in particular to assume that the Greek and Latin must somehow be particularly closely related to one another at a linguistic level as well. Mm-hmm. Partly because they're not unrelated. They mm-hmm. do, mm-hmm. In fact, share a lot of common features. But actually, there are if one does try to prioritize which of the Indo-European sub-branches are more closely related to which, mm-hmm. Latin actually belongs to a branch that's closer to the Celtic languages, mm-hmm. and Greek belongs to a branch that's closer to the Indo-Iranian languages, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which we can see with things like how the verbs work.
Right. Interesting. So it's largely like you're pointing to these sort of cultural underpinnings here, that are responsible. But of course, in your book, you're trying to also give us a sense of not just the cultural aspects, but the sounds of the languages, their syntax, and things like that. So let's start with the sounds of the language. Let's start with the sounds of Greek and Latin. Can you recite a little bit of ancient Greek to give us a sense of what it would have sounded like, someone singing the Iliad, any of these kinds of texts.
Yeah, well, I mean, this always, of course, has to be, there's inevitably the disclaimer that mm-hmm. in the absence of recordings, we can't know for sure how these things
exactly,
are pronounced.
Right.
Although we can do a pretty good job of making educated guesses, but mm-hmm. yeah, so just the opening lines of the Iliad. Men in aerete a pele iado akaleos ulo menen he muri akaios alge eteke polas diptimus piukas aeri proiapsen hero on autus de heloria telke cunesen oio nois itapasi dios detaleat obule exudet ha prota diastet hen erisante atreides te anaxandron kai dios akileus.
All right, so unless our listeners are already classicists familiar with ancient Greek, the hackneyed saying is in everyone's mind. That's all Greek to me, right? So
yes, I suppose you'd like a translation now.
Yeah. So now the question is: now we want to translate this, but as you point out in your discussion of this section, there's some challenges that translators face in translating this. So maybe mm-hmm. what does it mean that you just said, just roughly, and then what are some spots where we can see the different flavor of Greek as opposed to English?
So first, just to give a rough translation, sing the wrath, goddess, of Peleus' son Achilles, accursed wrath, which made countless pains for the Achaeans and sent forth many noble souls to Hades. souls of heroes, and it made them pray for the dogs and for all the birds, and the will of Zeus was being accomplished. From the point when they first were at odds, having quarreled, both Atreus son Agamemnon, lord of men, and godlike Achilles. So in terms of sort of issues that translators face, one can begin with the very first word of the poem, manen. Mm-hmm. It begins with the word for rage or wrath. The problem being that it has an N at the end of it, which is a signal that it is in the so-called accusative case. This is where morphology comes into play. It means it has an ending that signals that it is the object of verb. The verb that follows immediately, the imperative aede, sing. Now, in English, we kind of need to have our objects follow our verbs. If we said wrath, sing, anger, sing, we're left with something which doesn't make sense, it doesn't work as English syntax. So we have to put the noun as an object after it, sing the wrath, sing of the wrath. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with this, however, is that it doesn't do justice to the fact that the very first word of the poem, which is prime literary real estate, is the word for anger, not the word for singing. And so we've lost something in the translation if we start with the word for singing rather than this really focal key word of wrath. There are ways around this. Robert Fagles, in his translation, simply doubles the word and translates rage, goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles, which is one way of dealing with this, quite a nice way, it seems to me, but it does suggest perhaps that the syntax is a little bit more disjointed than is really the case, where it's perfectly smooth syntax in Greek to have the object first and the verb following. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of issue where the concepts of morphology and word order and syntax interact in a neat way, with Greek morphology allowing a pattern word order that English just can't do. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there are also other higher order literary issues in play here as well. The word manus happens to be used primarily of gods in the Iliad. And so it's a little bit striking to see it being used of Achilles. Mm-hmm. But then the excerpt ends with Achilles being described as deos, an adjective that can mean either godlike or brilliant, and which again sort of is a little bit fuzzy in terms of how much divinity it's attributing to Achilles, who after all has a divine mother. So I pity the translator who's trying to work out how to actually convey all of this additional resonance that you have if you have the Greek words dealing with an English translation.
Yeah. So you're pointing to here. You have the trying to catch all of these different constituent parts: the sound, the morphology, the things that make up the sense. There are choices here. You can pick one or the other. Sometimes maybe you can get two, but getting all of these sort of flavors, to use the metaphor that we're using, at once just seems basically impossible for a translator. You're going to have to choose what the dominant flavor is you want to pick up.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like: no fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. bookstagram.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, so Greek and Latin, we're putting in a pair here sort of in our conversation. So maybe we can turn to Latin. Can you give us an excerpt of Latin to contrast them? How do they sound? Are they different in their sounds? They sound the same? And we can talk about their meaning and structure.
So for Latin, I suppose I'll read something which is similar in that it uses a related poetic form, mm-hmm. poetic meter. The opening of Horace's ode 4-7, Di fugere anyways, rediunt iam gramine campis arboribusque comae, mutat terra vices, et decrescentia ripas flumina praeteriunt. Which I'll translate using A.E. Housman's translation of it. The snows are fled away, leaves on the shaws and grasses in the mid renew their birth. The river to the riverbed withdraws, and altered is the passion of the earth.
Okay. So they sound different, right? So what is it that we're hearing that's different in the sounds specifically? What's responsible for that difference?
Well, one thing that characterizes the sound of Latin as opposed to Greek is that whereas Greek retained sounds that were so-called aspirates, pa, mm-hmm. ta, and ka, mm-hmm. As the letters which are now actually pronounced as fricatives, mm-hmm. phi, theta, and chi. Mm-hmm. Latin changed a lot of these sounds to Fs and Hs, and so we get, with the double F in di fugere, we end up getting a sound which is not a very Greek sound. Mm-hmm. So that's one difference in the phonology. In terms of the morphology of Latin, the languages are alike, and they compared to English, they are both languages which are rich in endings for verbs and nouns, and so mm-hmm. they both are able to do a lot more. They can play a lot more with word order in mm-hmm. order to because without obscuring the syntax. What's different about Latin as a language relative to Greek in terms of its structure? A couple of things that stand out. Greek, like English, has a definite article. Latin mm-hmm. does not. Mm-hmm. One thing that really comes across in Housman's translation there is something like the very first two words of the poem are di fugere nives. So just two words in Latin. The first verb means sort of literally they have scattered. The second word is the word for snows. But what's just two words of Latin becomes five words in Husband's translation. The snows are fled away. This gives Latin superficially the appearance of being a very concise language, a very mm-hmm. matter-of-fact, to-the-point language. None of these sort of helping verbs needed. We don't need are or away, because we can express mm-hmm. all this with our single verb form, di fugere. We don't need to have mm-hmm. both the and snows, mm-hmm. because we can do that all just with niways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit misleading, because if you start turning things like syllable count instead, then mm-hmm. Latin actually ends up being comparable to English. Right. But it remains the case that if you're looking at a Latin text, it often has far fewer words mm-hmm. Than a corresponding English text. Mm-hmm. So that's one respect in which right. Latin does have something a little bit different going forward than Greek. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good. And it seems like this is a theme too that we'll see pick up in some of the other languages, this sort of relative economy with lexical units. Let's say, like you were saying, in terms of syllables, it may turn out that some of them are similar in terms of syllable count, but in terms of discrete lexical units, it seems like some of these dead languages are able to do a lot more than English is able to do in terms of expressing meaning.
Yeah, so it certainly.
Yeah. No, please go ahead.
Yeah. It certainly is one of the respects in which it is useful to view these dead languages as a group, because that is one, with these particular languages at least, it does seem to be a shared feature of them relative to modern languages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, the other thing too, which really should be said about Latin, and the sound that it has for English speakers, which may be hard to get from hearing a random, for a non-Latin speaker to hear. Mm-hmm. It's nothing you're going to hear so much when you just have four lines of chorus thrown at
sure.
you. But if you look at it on the page, it looks a lot more familiar than Greek does, not only because mm-hmm. of the alphabet, which is a pretty trivial difference,
sure.
But because of so much more of English vocabulary is taken from Latin, either directly or by way of French.
Yeah.
And one of the things which makes which makes Greek kind of special as a language for English speakers is that the sort of vocabulary that we borrow from Greek enters a different register of English mm-hmm. than what we borrowed from Latin.
Yeah.
So disciplines like anthropology, geology, history, music, mm-hmm. physics, mm-hmm. These all get what are ultimately Greek names. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing for poor Latin is that if you sort of look at your inbox and mm-hmm. sort of think about the emails that you're getting from, say, the university administration, mm-hmm. words like report, committee, educational, curriculum, assessment, exercise, and yes, administration itself, these are all coming from Latin.
Right.
So it's very hard at some level to, as an English speaker, not to see the sort of bureaucratic veneer when mm-hmm. you're reading Latin, and you have to remember, mm. no, these words are not polluted yet for the Latin speakers. they are still really fresh and vibrant ways of expressing
mm-hmm.
things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So let's turn to the Old English and Germanic languages. You made reference to these a little bit already, and talking about you know, English and its relationship to sort of Proto-Indo-European languages. So let's try and situate these languages. How old is Old English, and would an English speaker today be able to understand it? I mean, it's just Old English, right? What's the difference here?
Old English would, as a matter of most Old English, 99% of Old English would not be comprehensible to mm-hmm. a modern English speaker. It refers not to something as similar to modern to contemporary English as, say, Shakespeare, which counts mm-hmm. as early modern English, mm-hmm. but broadly speaking, it refers to English spoken before the Norman conquest of 1066. At this point, Norman French enters the picture, and there's some pretty significant changes in how English works into the Middle English period. Really, with Old English, we're looking at the period from roughly the 5th century AD, when mm-hmm. the Angles and Saxons first are invited over mm-hmm. as mercenaries by the Romano-British to Britain. Up to 1066, although the actual records that we have don't start till a couple of centuries after that. As for how intelligible it would or wouldn't be, by and large, it would not be intelligible, but you can construct sentences in Old English that would be intelligible. Mm-hmm. So Mitchell and Robinson's Guide to Old English actually starts its reading practice in Old English with some great sentences like, "His bed is under him," which mm-hmm. would have been the same, which would be completely comprehensible. Mm-hmm. I think a nice comparandum for this is actually Dutch. So too with Dutch, you can make up sentences like "De man is here," mm-hmm. which you can understand if you're an English speaker, but you have to pick your vocabulary pretty carefully in right. order to get the words that show the relationship between the two.
Gotcha.
To give an example that would be a little bit more representative of what normal Old English might have sounded like, mm-hmm. I'll offer the Old English of John 3:16. Okay. So first in the King James Version, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life." In Old English, "God lupode mid on art, swa that he sowed his on canadon sunu, that non ne forwerte the on hina yelus, ak habithat h yelif." So I doubt that many listeners mm-hmm. without training in mm-hmm. Old English would be able to make much of that. even if they, with the translation hand, can start to see some pretty close similarities.
Right. So you spend some time in your book looking at Beowulf, which is maybe if people know anything about Old English and the Germanic languages, a literary work people are familiar with. And you pick it in some ways because, you know, you've looked at the Iliad before, and the Iliad and Beowulf have some similarities in both being these lengthy epic poems. Again, we've discussed how they're related to Proto-Indo-European. But the Beowulf has some different features, and in particular here, we're, you know, this use of compounds, I mean, maybe we can talk about. So could you read us a bit of Beowulf and then talk about the use of compounds in the language?
All right, so one bit that I talk about in the book, Swa shall yon gruma goda yuwerchan, fromum feochiftum on fatterbarma, fatina on ilda efti wunigan, will ye see thus gona we kuma, leuri elastum, loft adam shall, and maitha yawara man yathone. So again, a very different sort of sound from the other languages that we've been looking at. And yeah, we get this word loftadam, for instance, with words of, with deeds of praise. And literally it's just the two words for praise and deed, loftad, smashed together. And this is a very Germanic way of doing things. Although I should also say it's a pretty common Indo-European way of doing things too. The simple act of compounding things it's something that we see also in Greek and certainly in Sanskrit. And it's what's a little bit more distinctive about the use of compounds here relative to, say, the Iliad, is that there are more of them that are nouns as opposed to adjectives. If we think about the sort of language that's characteristic of even translations of the Iliad, it's things like rosy-fingered dawn. Where it's that adjective rosy-fingered that we see as the compound. And that's perhaps where the center of gravity of the compounds of the Iliad lies, as opposed to something like a word which literally would be praise deed. And we can make sense of that in English. We could, if we wanted to, have a really literal translation that translates it like that. Mm-hmm. But we can see why a translator like Donaldson might go for through deeds that bring praise as a way of making it a little bit more natural, a way of expressing it in the modern language.
Good. And so one of the things that you're, again, back to the main thrust of your book that you're trying to point out here is that for someone who's listening to Beowulf, when they heard, was it Lofdatum, they would have not heard it so much as praise deeds, but they would have had an understanding of its meaning in context, but it would have been conveyed in this compound form, whereas someone who's listening to the poem in translation, they're hearing the content in a different way, in a different structure. And so there's some aspect that's just a different kind of flavoring to how we're experiencing the poem, even if maybe we can get onto the same meaning. Is that kind of close to what you're trying to point out?
Yes, it's certainly close. I should also, however, be careful in noting that we also need to regard this as being a particular type of Old English. This is poetry, and so it's not, this is not the way the Anglo-Saxon on the street would have spoken. and the density of the compounds that one gets does seem to be indicative of a more poetic register of language. That said, there are enough of them, and this seems to be a common enough feature of all the early Germanic poetic traditions, that it seems that they would be sort of accustomed to hearing this sort of compound noun with greater frequency than we are now.
Gotcha. Well, let's keep pressing on. We have a lot of languages in the book to look at. And another one is Old Irish. So you look at Old Irish and Welsh, and you know, maybe this, at least to me, it was a little surprising. I don't know much about Old Irish, and you said that it's arguably the most difficult of the Indo-European languages. You know, and I would have thought, well, Sanskrit certainly has some pride of place there, right? But you use some sentences to sort of exemplify Old English and to show some of the difficulty in it, and also, again, like we've been saying, some of the flavor here. So let's start with Old Irish before we get to Welsh. Can you read a little bit of Old Irish for us? Talk to us about what it is that's so difficult about it.
Yes. So The thing about so certainly Sanskrit also a difficult language. I don't mean to minimize by any means the amount of effort it takes to learn it well. Now, but the thing about Old Irish that makes it different from Sanskrit is a vastly greater amount of irregularity. For the most part, if you're learning how a Sanskrit noun or verb works, there will be other nouns or verbs that follow that same pattern. With Irish, one is not nearly so lucky. And there is a general tendency as in the history of languages, languages like to be regular. And so you often have at one point an equilibrium where you have a regular pattern of endings that you put on a noun. But then you might have a sound change take place. And sound changes typically take place in a way that has no respect for endings as such. It will simply, that sound change will take place no matter where that sound is in a word, whether or not it's in the middle of the word, sort of the root of the word, or if it's in an ending where it's doing something different. And often once a sound change has taken place, it will affect part of a class of words, but not another part of that class of words. And what used to be a single pattern becomes two patterns. Now, sensible languages then typically decide, no, this is too cognitively difficult. We can't have these two separate patterns. And what's called analogical leveling takes place. What have been two different patterns get leveled out, a single pattern spreads by analogy from one class to the other. And what makes Old Irish hard is that they were not very keen on doing analogical leveling. They sort of accumulated one sound change after another, each progressively making, sort of splintering things into multiple patterns, and never sort of going back and straightening things out again. And so this is what makes it particularly challenging as a language. So you end up with things like the word for woman in the nominative singular is ben, and in the nominative plural, it's manal, which is not a very easy pattern to remember.
Yeah. So it's complicated in its irregularity, and you just gave us one example, at least of a single word and inflected differently. What about some longer passages? You talk a little bit about there's some difficulties in getting. Getting the literature, I think, in the first place because of limitations on what we have extant and things. But what's a good example for us? What kind of literature is it from?
The most famous work written in some form of medieval Irish is the Toin Bo Cuilinge, the cattle raid of Cooley. And this is part of what's called the Ulster Cycle, which is a collection of stories about heroes who are geographically located largely in the north of Ireland, hence the term Ulster Cycle. In the Toin Bo Cuilinge, the main hero is Cú Chulainn, whose name literally means the Hound of Chulainn, and it tells of his heroic deeds when a rival group was trying to undertake a cattle raid, which is a pretty common class of stories in medieval Irish literature. And right here, we see some respects in, as strange a language as Irish can be at first glance. The fact that Cú Chulainn's name, Cú, the first element, is the word for hound or dog, and that's cognate with canis in Latin and Cúon in Greek. And in the title of the poem, the Toin Bo Cuilinge, Bo is the word for the raid of the cattle, and that's cognate with bovine, which we get from Latin. So, it's both, it's certainly less familiar to most English speakers than, say, the Iliad or much of Latin poetry, but it does ultimately still have an Indo-European background.
Great. And then real briefly, I want to make sure we get to Sanskrit and Hebrew too, but you also talk about Welsh in this chapter. So how is Welsh related to Irish historically and linguistically?
Well, both Welsh and Irish belong to the Celtic branch of the Indo-European family. And all branches are characterized by particular changes that they undergo together. One of the most famous ones about the Celtic languages is that they lost all their inherited P sounds. Mm-hmm. And so all those words for father and fish don't start with any consonant. And so rather than pater, father, the word for father in all Irish is author, and the word for fish, rather than being piscus or fish, is isk. So that's sort of one diagnostic feature of the Celtic languages. Within the Celtic languages, there are some spoken further back in antiquity that are whose affiliations are a little bit more vexed. But in terms of Irish and Welsh, they belong to the two main branches of the Celtic languages spoken today, which are in effect characterized by whether or not they reintroduced a P sound and how quickly they did. So we can see this happening with words that originally started with a qua sound. The words for four and five were something like the Latin words quatuor and quinque. In Irish, these continue to have a sort of K sound at the start, so the words are cether and coig, but this qua sound turns into a P in Welsh, leaving us with pedwar and pimp as the words for four and five.
Okay, good. So that gives us sort of a sense of both the relationship of them to one another and then the relationship more broadly to the other languages. So let's shift gears. We have two other languages we can maybe touch on briefly. So you talk about Sanskrit, of course. This is a language close to my own heart. And your discussion of it opens up with one of my favorite quotes that I like to talk about with my classicist friends, with Sir William Jones, who is an Indologist, and he characterizes Sanskrit as more perfect than Greek and more copious than Latin and more exquisitely refined than either one of them. And now, obviously, your book is not making these kinds of evaluative sort of comparisons about languages, but you do observe some ways in which Sanskrit is like Greek and Latin. So what are some of these similarities? And, you know, maybe you can point to what people conclude based on them.
Well, one similarity is sort of right there at the very beginning of the first Sanskrit text that I talk about, which is the opening of the Rig Veda. The very first hymn opens Agni Meile, I praise Agni, the god of fire. Right from the start, we see an object that's placed before its verb in a way that we can't do in English, but we can do, as we saw, in Greek and also in Latin. We also see that Agni's name here ends in an M. This is historically the same as the N that marked it as being an object in Maine and as being an object in Greek. We also see, shift to a different European language, that his name is cognate with the Latin word ignis, the word for fire. So it's not as foreign. When one sees Agni, especially if one sees in Devanagari, the proper writing system for it, and looks completely opaque, but there's actually quite a lot there that's familiar. Yep. The very next line, Yajnasya Devam Urtijam, the word Devam for divine is again maps very closely onto the English word divine, which we have from Latin. And finally, to give another example of a more grammatical feature, Agni keeps being described by these various appositives. He's the chief priest, the hotaram, and the most giving of treasure, ratna datamam. And this tamam suffix, ratna datamam, is equivalent to the most that we see in the English most giving or granting of treasure. And that might not seem like a connection until we consider some of the words that we have in English that go back to Latin and its superlatives, where we get, if we have words like the Latin word for best is optimum, which has the same tamum suffix, and words like, intimate and ultimate. Go back to the Latin words intimum and ultimum, which again have timum and attached onto these stems in and ul. So just with sort of picking just three very short lines of Sanskrit text, we can actually find quite a few grammatical features that map directly onto Greek and Latin.
Yeah. And so then, it has these sort of shared features. What kind of would make a flavor that's Sanskritic here? So again, thinking back to our metaphor, what would make something Sanskritic versus Latinate or Greek in its, maybe in its sound or its structure?
It's hard to know where to begin. In terms of the sound, one thing which strikes anybody who's learning Sanskrit is the feature of santi, which is a feature whereby in English, when we pronounce words in quick succession, we don't articulate the boundaries between the words. And so a sequence like don't you think becomes don't you think. And we actually take the sound of the T of don't changes a little bit in front of the U, the Y sound of U, and becomes the affricate ch. We occasionally write this out in English if we're doing, writing dialogue that's supposed to be colloquial, but it's not a regular feature of how we represent our language.
Right.
Not so Sanskrit. Sanskrit very systematically indicates the changes that take place when the end of one word butts up against the beginning of the next word. And so it does provide a really beautiful continuity of sound that one sees on the page in a way that one doesn't get in standard editions of Greek and Latin or English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Sunday is the bane of many a starting Sanskrit student, for sure, and sometimes even those of us who've been with the language for a while. So in the time we have left, let's make sure not to omit Hebrew. This is the one Semitic language in the book that you treat. So maybe let's start with, what's the difference between Indo-European and Semitic languages, and why would you look at a book on Hebrew in a book on primarily Indo-European dead languages?
The chief difference between the Indo-European languages and Semitic languages is they go back to different common ancestors. The Indo-European languages all go back to Proto-Indo-European. Languages like Hebrew, Arabic, and Akkadian all go back to a common ancestor called Proto-Semitic. They do have many of the same categories that Indo-European languages have. So, yeah, nouns get different endings if they're plural, or verbs change the form to indicate that they're a different tense. But a lot of the formal ways that Semitic languages do this are a bit different. So it can be useful to see what the different options are for forming tenses, let's say, in a different way. For doing morphology in a different way. In particular, but probably the most famous fact about the Semitic languages is that they have triconsonantal roots as the building block of the language. And so we see this even with borrowings from Arabic into English of Islam and Muslim and Salam as three different words. They all have that S-L-M sequence as a common root, but different prefixes get sort of put at the start, or different words are inserted in the middle of them, sometimes between the first and second consonant, sometimes between the second and third consonant. And this is something which doesn't work in the same way in the Indo-European languages. It's not that we don't have roots like this. We see something sort of similar with English patterns like ride, road, ridden, where we can play around with what vowel we have in the middle of a word there. There's typically, with an Indo-European root, only that one slot that you're really playing around with, whereas with the triconsonantal root system of the Semitic languages, you have two places, two slots word internally to play around with, in addition to prefixes and suffixes. It's useful to look at Semitic languages so just as a chance to see, to learn more about how the Indo-European ones works by contrast, and to learn what's specific to them as opposed to just generally a principle of how languages work.
Right. I was just going to ask you to maybe show us an example or speak, give us an example of some Hebrew for that purpose.
So just to keep it relatively short, perhaps the bit of Genesis 4:8 in English first. This is, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. Vayehi bihyotam basadeh vayakum Cain al hevel achiv vayahargehu. So we are getting different sounds here. The Semitic languages have many more sounds that are pronounced further back in the throat than we have in most of the older Indo-European languages, although Proto-Indo-European itself probably had some of these sounds. But one of the things that's most distinctive here is, as we see in the translation, this phrase, and it came to pass when they were in the field, which actually other translations like the New Revised Standard leave out and simply say, and when they were in the field. But Hebrew is very fond of using this form vayehi, and it was, and it came to pass, in a way that forms a syntactic hook to hang various sorts of dependent clauses on. That's characteristic of the Hebrew Bible. Translators picked up on this, and it becomes a feature of biblical pastiche language as well, because it worked its way into Greek, and from Greek into Latin, and from Latin into English.
Right. By way of the Septuagint and so on and so forth, right? Great. So this has been a sort of a jaunt through, a romp through, I don't know what the word would be, through a quick run through several languages, many thousands of years worth of linguistic change. And the book, of course, goes into a lot more detail about each of them, gives many more examples that maybe listeners who are interested in can take a look at that. But let's just wrap up by thinking about the book doesn't really have a conclusion, in the sense that you're showing us a bunch of these different languages and pointing out some very specific similarities and differences and things like that. So maybe let's end with this. Returning a little bit to why you wrote this book, what at the end of reading this book do you hope listeners take away in terms of why are these languages interesting for us? We're thousands of years away from the Bible and Beowulf and so on. What should we learn from this book?
I think it's precisely because we're thousands of years away from them that they're worth looking at. I mean, how many of us are doing things today that we can be confident that 2,000, 3,000 years from now, they will matter, that anybody will know that we've done them? The mere fact that these texts have survived for so long gives them, in my eye, a sort of transcendence that makes it a downright sublime matter to be able to be part of a conversation that includes them. So largely just for a sense of perspective on where we are now, where we've come from, a sense of humility of knowing that we only occupy a really small slice of human history ourselves, and that insofar as just as if you really want to get to know a great city like Paris, you need to actually go there and speak French with the natives and understand the language through which they view the world. And similarly, the closest we get to time travel is to be able to read these texts in their original language.
To pick up the book and to learn some languages. What are you working on now that the book is finished? What are your other projects?
Now, at the moment, I'm working on trying to teach online, as most of my fellow faculty
like
are.
Yeah.
But my next project is back to a more narrow scholarly audience of people working on Greek, a book on Greek prose style. There's been a lot of work done recently in Greek linguistics on things like how word order works, which is really not well understood until as recently as 20 or 30 years ago. And while there's been a lot of good linguistic research on this, people haven't been doing so much with understanding how different Greek authors are manipulating the basic rules in different ways in order to achieve their own particular stylistic goals. So this is my main project right now.
Okay. Just curious, which authors are you looking at?
I'm I'm not sure yet how many I will end up including. It depends on how big the chapters end up being of the authors that I cover. But primarily, I'm interested in Attic prose. Yes, I'll probably start with Herodotus, but I am mostly, I imagine, going to begin with Thucydides and get as far as I can before the book becomes unmanageably big.
That sounds great. Well, thank you again for your time, Coulter. I appreciate it. And we'll have a link up to the book, How Dead Languages Work, just out not too long ago by Oxford University Press. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.